As school begins around the world, there is a dark, emotional, and sometimes physical cloud that floats over and darkens the lives of some students, parents, teachers, and school administrators.
Bullying, it's learned behavior. The best way to counteract a bully is to treat that bully with lots of love, patience, Christ-like compassion. But I would tell the parents, first of all, to see if there's something in their own lives where the child may be learning this behavior.
We'll talk about bullying just a little bit later on today's edition of Come Receive the Light. And somewhat related, neurobiology is the study of cells of the nervous system and the organization of those cells into functional circuits that process information and mediate behavior, behavior that can sometimes be considered sin.
You know, man is composed of soul and body together. The soul can't do anything without the body, nor the body without the soul, as the Holy Fathers tell us. So there's always something physical, something neurobiological involved in our behavior.
Welcome to another edition of Come Receive the Light. I'm Mike Trout, and our host each week is Father Christopher Metropoulos. We're on the web at myocn.net. That's myocn.net. Well, the Bible has a great deal to say about sin. We have all been conceived in sin. Paul told the church at Ephesus, "Be angry and do not sin." In John, Jesus said, "He who is without sin can cast the first stone." In the book of Psalms, David pleaded with God to cleanse him of all sin. And of course, in the end, Christ died for our sins. What is it that causes us to sin? Well, there's a question with either no clear answer or 1,000 answers. Today, our featured guest is going to take us into the world of neurobiology for a deeper look at why we do the things we do, including sin. His Eminence Archbishop Lazar is a retired hierarch of the Orthodox Church in America and founding abbot of the Monastery of All Saints of North America in Canada. He has served as a clergyman in various ranks in the Russian Orthodox Church outside Russia, the Free Serbian Orthodox Church, the Church of the Genuine Orthodox Christians of Greece, the Holy Synod of Milan, the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, and the Orthodox Church in America. He's a prolific writer, and he published a work in 2010, entitled On the Neurobiology of Sin, and talked with our host, Father Chris, about that particular article.
I'd like to start by asking you to tell us how the Orthodox Church, Your Eminence, defines sin, because it's different from the mainstream Western idea, isn't it?
Yes. At some point in the West, sin began to be defined simply as violation or breaking of a law. The word amartia, sometimes from the Greek, somehow became translated into Latin as sontus, which means guilt, and it really became kind of forensic idea, and was it reinterpreted in the dialectic of the Roman law court. And this founded the basis for the understanding of sin in the West.
So if we think of sin then as falling short or missing the mark instead of, well, running in the opposite direction, what does a sin tell us about how we're using our energy?
Well, that's a primary factor in Orthodox Christian understanding, because sin really is the misuse of our energies. Mm-hmm. And it's foundational in Orthodox theology to understand the uncreated energies of God and the created energy of man and how we're using them. The thing is that sin really is a matter of alienation. Really, the parable of the prodigal son tells the whole story. The younger son becomes alienated from the father and goes farther away from him, becomes further alienated. But we understand that the father's forgiveness followed him the day he left, not the day he came back, and that he had to turn around and change his perspective, change his mind, turn around and go the opposite direction back to the father, and that this was the actual healing of the alienation. When he came back to the father, the father was waiting for him, constantly looking and watching for him to come back. And before he could even have his repentance out of his mouth, he had a ring on his finger and a robe on his shoulders, and the father was rejoicing. And I think this is very important for us to understand in the whole relationship, because very often we think only about some kind of juridical justification in the West.
Yes.
And we forget that that justice really means to set things back in balance. It doesn't mean to punish. So the problem for mankind really is the misuse of our energy.
And how does neurobiology then fit into this?
Well, we're talking about things we know a little more about, the things that we consider sin. Now, the reason I chose the subject, the neurobiology of sin, is because many times in confession, you know, people seldom ever have an actual confession anymore. They nick in Sunday morning and want a magic prayer so they can take communion, and they say a couple of things about their daily sins. That's not really what confession is about. But when the priest hears a proper confession, very often our priests are not equipped really to understand what's going on within a person.
Mm-hmm.
And very often the things that they say in confession can be an indication of some serious physical or psychiatric problem in which a priest needs to really refer someone to another kind of professional.
Mm-hmm.
But we also have to understand that what we would call sins, I don't even like the word, but what we would call sins, are not like a toggle switch. You can't just turn these things on and off. There are, you know, man is soul and body, composed of soul and body together.
Yes.
The soul can't do anything without the body, nor the body without the soul, as the Holy Fathers tell us. So there's always something physical, something neurobiological involved in our behavior. And when we look at the Christian life as being just externally correct behavior and don't realize that there are all kinds of problems going on within the mind itself, within the brain, that can affect our behavior, then we can very often do more harm than good in confession. So I'm really interested in examining the way that even problems in our neurobiology can create the kind of external behavior that's judged as sin. Psychiatric illnesses, for example, are certainly not demonic possessions,
mm-hmm.
and they need to... We as clergy are not capable of handling them. We can work together with mental health caregivers in many cases. And this is, I think, extremely important for us to study and to cooperate between our Orthodox mental health caregivers and priests a little bit more. We've seen some real catastrophes over the years that have taken place in confession by people who are completely unaware of the neurobiological aspect of human behavior,
mm-hmm.
and thinking that things were just, you know, an act of will or miswill. That's what I'm focusing on.
Okay. And then how, Your Eminence, should the church respond to people who suffer from these types of ailments? Because as you said before, they were considered demon possessions.
They were. And, you know, I think a lot of you will be familiar with the terrible episode where a novice nun was actually killed by a priest in northern Romania while he was trying to exorcise the demon. And in fact, she was schizophrenic, didn't have a demon at all.
Oh, my.
And he's in jail right now for it. And I'm surprised we haven't had more lawsuits for malpractice from that sort of thing.
Sure.
I've seen people's lives and families destroyed because a priest would insist that there was a demonic possession when in fact they were bipolar,
mm-hmm.
or a young person has borderline personality disorder, which we can't do anything about, and we could press the person though to suicide by focusing on sin in the sort of sectarian way, you know, sin, and making it a forensic thing instead of realizing that there are really serious neurobiological problems that figure into human behavior, and they have to be taken into account, and we have to watch for signs of them.
So we're talking about further education then for clergy, and
we are
also...
You know, I'll give you an example that I've had only twice a young person in confession say that they couldn't sleep at night because their mind was racing all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now that could be prodromal of schizophrenic or a psychotic break, because the racing mind is something that we hear constantly from people who are either schizophrenic or bipolar.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens then is when a person has this racing of the mind and you begin to put pressure on them by questioning them or pressing them or trying to put more guilt on them for behavior or something, the mind races more.
Sure.
And we can actually advance the psychotic break.
Well, we also have diseases like alcoholism that we're now finding out to be somewhat genetic. Tell us a little bit about biological aspects to some sinful behaviors.
Say you find somebody who seems to be, say, very arrogant, know-it-all, and pushy, and you start talking to them about their relationships with other people, and you have to kind of be aware that a lot of problems can be handled by a proper confession. They can be handled even psychosomatically by a proper confession. But in cases where you have that kind of bullying and things, sometimes it's your orbital frontal cortex is simply not active enough. And it's giving a false impression to the person of their self-identity, because that's where self-identity is. It takes place. The other thing I wanted to say something about, if you have time,
of course.
The thing about whether something is genetic or not has become more ideology than knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
Let's take cystic fibrosis, for example. When there's no gene that sat there and says, I'm cystic fibrosis and I'm going to give you cystic fibrosis, there's a gene that's supposed to produce a protein that sets a regulator in an inner membrane pump for the cells. And if that's not there, the salinity balance in the cell is off, and then the body begins to fill up with mucus, and the person can choke to death. And the gene doesn't cause cystic fibrosis. The absence of the protein causes cystic fibrosis. So the gene may not be turned on by an epigenetic switch, or maybe malfunctioning for some other reason. It doesn't produce the protein. So it's the absence of the protein that causes the problem. And this can be the same with any kind of psychiatric problem or psychological problem or something that creates behavioral issues. And I think a few years ago, there was a man who was arrested because he'd suddenly become pedophilic and was chasing little girls. And while he was in prison, he had these enormous headaches. And they took him to hospital and found that in the prefrontal lobe there was a tumor.
Mm.
When they removed it, he wasn't a pedophile anymore.
Oh, my.
It was the pressure in that prefrontal lobe, you know, that was creating the problem. And that's why also we have to realize, you know, the word passion doesn't mean sin. It means suffering.
Mm.
And a lot of problems arise from our inner human suffering and the fact that we need to respond to those and be able to help people with inner human suffering. It brings those passions under control and realize that there can be other things going on in the brain that could indicate a more serious problem. When a man suddenly starts beating his wife, or when a wife suddenly becomes angry and agitated, there's something else going on. This is not just an act of her will that's leading her into sin.
Okay. Let's talk for a minute about parents and children. Even in cases where there isn't a genetic or biological link, we know that we learn things from our parents. So if a father is openly promiscuous or a mother is emotionally abusive, it's not unlikely that their children will engage in the same sinful behavior, right?
Well, in fact, it's true, and perhaps that's what the prophet means when he said the sins of the parents, fathers visit the children to the seventh generation. Mm-hmm. Not that the children are guilty, but that they inherit the consequences. We know that girls who are raised in a family where the father's quite abusive often marry an abusive man.
Mm.
And of course, we build up expectations. A lot of the problems in marriage are that the husband and the wife come from families where there were different expectations of what the family was about from their childhood. And we have to realize we develop like layers of an onion, you know, that the child that we were is always within us, and that somehow we have to become a parent to ourselves as well as to our own children. And we do repeat the things that we learned in the household when we have children, and we do have expectations that are based on the way parents behave in the family. And this is why when we talk about the education of children in a general sense, we're not just talking about school and learning, we're also talking about patterns of understanding and behavior that the parents form in children. And that's something, too, that should be talked about sometimes.
Okay. Your Eminence, it's been really enlightening to speak to you. I thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us about these delicate and, yes, very serious situations. I think we've all learned a great deal, and I hope you'll come back to speak with us again. And, of course, we ask for your blessings.
Oh, God bless us, and thank you so much.
If you'd like to read the entire article on the neurobiology of sin by Archbishop Lazar, we will have a link to it on our website. That's myocn.net. Just click on the Listen button at the top of our homepage and select CRTL. That's myocn.net. And the article should be attached to this particular broadcast.
If there is a very serious form of bullying, parents should not be afraid to ask for help from a counselor, from a therapist, from a guidance counselor, from a priest.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Sometimes in the church, we tend to think that we don't need that stuff. However, all those social sciences, what they do is they build us up so that we could truly and purely worship God in the way we were created to.
Father Mark Leondis is currently the pastor of St. Mark Greek Orthodox Church in Boca Raton, Florida. He has been the National Director of Youth and Young Adult Ministries for the Greek Orthodox Archdiocese of America, and he spoke with our host, Father Chris, about the subject of bullying.
Thanks for being with us today, Father.
My pleasure, Father Chris.
I've read a lot lately, and I've seen that bullying has become a very serious problem. I mean, it's even caused a number of young kids to take their own lives recently. What are we talking about here, Father, and how can we deal with this?
Well, bullying is a very serious thing. Sometimes we think of it as, oh, it's just a grade school kind of thing that takes place. But it does not just happen in the schoolyard anymore. It takes place at school for sure, in families, at work, even in youth groups. You name it, I think you can really see this. Anywhere there's a group of people, but there are different kinds of bullying. And I think there's the physical bullying, when somebody physically hurts another person.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's also, which can be just as damaging and even worse, is emotional and psychological bullying. And that many times is verbal, as well as nonverbal looks, ignoring, brushing past people, many different avenues.
You know, I think it's hard for parents because there's always been bullying. I mean, I remember when I was in the in first grade, I remember, I couldn't go to the recess, and my father had to come to recess because three kids were beating me up every day.
Right.
So there's been bullying for a while, but I mean, how can parents tell when it's coming from just a bunch of kids? Is it just kids' problems, young things, it's an innocent thing, or is it really a problem today?
You know, I think it's different in every case. As a parent, and think about, like you said, with your own children and my children, one needs to assess the situation, how the child is reacting to the bullying.
Mm-hmm.
Some kids can have negative things said and ignore it completely, while other kids can't tolerate those exact same words.
Mm-hmm.
So it has to do with how the young person reacts to it. Some people have a higher tolerance than others, and a parent needs to assess that, what that tolerance is for each child. And it'll vary for each child and their family. But if they notice that their child is becoming angry, acting out, extremely emotional, sleeping a lot, not sleeping enough, and they believe it's related to bullying, then it's an obvious red flag that they have to act on.
Well, you're pointing to a very important part, and you're using the word, using it but not using it, a connection between kids and parents. And many times today, we have the kids being more mature than the parents. So how do we improve that kid-parent relationship to the point where they feel open enough to be able to talk about bullying?
Well, I think first and foremost, you have to know what's going on. You need to have an active presence in your child's life. And this means not just sitting with them two or three times a week at dinner. It means talking to them, spending time with them, for our sake, going to church with them, sharing your life or their life with them, and listening to them. Too often we talk to our kids and don't listen to them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's definitely an issue that has to be addressed, because there's young people do not have enough positive role models in their lives as adults.
Now that our kids are off and it's summertime, of course, they spend a little more time, especially here in Florida, it's very, very hot. So either they're in the pool, in the ocean, or in air conditioning. When they're in air conditioning, it means they're usually near the television or reading. When they're near the television, they need some of the new technologies that are out now, whether it be the cartoons or the video games or whatever it is. There's a lot of bullying in that stuff. I see a lot of rough, violent stuff that kids are exposed to. Have you seen that, Father?
Absolutely. Cartoons nowadays are not the Tom and Jerry that when we were younger watching. Nowadays, the cartoons have characters that have real serious concerns, and bullying is one of them, which really shows forth.
Mm-hmm.
I think when we talk about, you know, new technologies, with social networking so popular, kids and adults, I think we all have to face that, are putting their private lives in a public sphere.
Yes.
And this, Father Chris, this is always dangerous and open our lives up, each of us, to criticism, judgment, you know, potential danger at times, unwarranted gossip, you know, non-friends, as we call them, quote-unquote, people mm-hmm. knowing too much about you.
Right.
And I think people post things that are not accurate or not true.
Right.
And they're pretending to be someone else in order to make that person look bad. You know, I remember a story working with a young person who in his sophomore year had a website put up about him by another teenager. Now, this site, Father, included lies, gossip. 2 years later, in his senior year, he was still feeling the repercussions of this cyberbullying, as we call it.
She was 2 years.
And this can take place through social networking, texting, instant messaging, and other ways. It's all around us.
And what about the person who's innocently on, let's say, I don't want to push any one type of social networking, but what about the young person who's on Facebook, who's being very innocent, and posting a lot of things about their personal life that normally they wouldn't put out on that highway of information, and then others use that to the detriment of the reputation of that person? Does that happen too?
Absolutely, and I think our young people have to be taught that what they put up on Facebook, even though they may feel like it's their own private page, it's going into a public sphere, and that sphere includes friends, for sure, and family members, but it also includes friends of friends and people that maybe they don't want this information to go to. But again, just like the old game of communication and telephone, when you tell it to one person, it's told to the next, and the story gets mixed up and gets confused. And when you do that online, you put something to a friend, it's again taken down that line.
Well, I'm sure there might be some parents who are listening, and let's try to throw a lifeline out to them. Parents, how can parents help their kids in dealing with bullying, whether school or in sports?
Well, this is a major issue. And I think we need to help young people, and the parents need to teach their children to try to let them figure it out first, empower them to solve their own problems. You don't want your child to become the target, because that, in essence, could be a very serious thing. It's okay to teach our kids, and I tell them all the time, my kids and the young people I work with, you can tell someone else, stop talking to me like that, or it's not okay for you to say that to me. And there's nothing wrong with that, but we have to empower them to be able to deal with these issues and not us always coming in to try to save them.
Okay. And what about, I mean, in Scripture, Christ himself said, turn the other cheek. I mean, how are we as Christians supposed to handle bullying?
Wow. It's not easy. And there's times where I myself feel like not turning the other cheek. Mm-hmm. But I think the important thing is to try and work it out on your own. Ignore it if you can. If you're getting hurt, physical, emotional, whatever it may be, then tell someone, a teacher, a counselor, a priest. Initially, the kid should be given the opportunity to handle the situation on their own. If they feel that doesn't work or can't work, and they try to ignore it, then tell them to stop. They need to get help.
Is bullying something parents should make a point of talking to their kids about, I mean, as a means of possibly even preventing it?
Absolutely, preventing it on both sides, from mm-hmm. being the victim, but also being the bully.
The bully, right.
Okay. And you know, what's interesting, Father, is that cases like this, bullying, it's learned behavior. The best way to counteract a bully, and I would say, is to treat that bully with lots of love, patience, Christ-like compassion. But I would tell the parents, first of all, to see if there's something in their own lives where the child may be learning this behavior. As I said, many times this is learned behavior. And with all learned behavior, this can be overcome. And sometimes it's not as intentional that what the young people are dealing with. However, maybe they're a little bit aggressive parents, or maybe the way they talk to others is a bad example for the young people.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I would begin a serious conversation with the child about why they're acting like this. Make it clear to them that this behavior is not acceptable. Too often, I think our kids are not given positive feedback. And remember, we always say it takes 9 positive comments, statistics tell us, to combat that one negative comment.
My goodness,
so
that's
a lot.
So
I would say start praising for the proper behavior now.
Wow. 9 positive comments.
9.
Okay. And what about if parents suspect or learn that their own child is a bully? I mean, what should they do?
Sit down with them, talk to them. Help their child make a plan so that when the situation arises, help them understand there is a better way. If there is a very serious form of bullying, parents should not be afraid to ask for help from a counselor, from a therapist, from a guidance counselor, from a priest.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Sometimes in the church, we tend to think that we don't need that stuff. However, all those social sciences, what they do is they build us up so that we could truly and purely worship God in the way we were created to.
Well, I'm sure this topic is on a lot of parents' minds as their kids are heading back to school, so I appreciate your talking with us today. listeners to hear more shows on parenting, check out our Mission Possible podcast. Thank you, Father Mark.
God bless, Father.
That particular podcast and many others can be found on our website at myocn.net. We're a nonprofit outreach and are supported by the generosity of folks just like yourself. Wherever you are in the world, if we're helping you, if we're meeting needs in some way, I hope you'll help us meet needs as well. You can contribute safely when you go to our website. Just click on the donate button on the homepage at myocn.net. I'm Mike Trout. Thank you for joining us. Our host each week is Father Christopher Metropoulos. Our executive producer is Ann Dankert. Special thanks to her this week. And remember, you can also follow us on Twitter and on Facebook. We'd love to know that you're out there. Get in touch with us and share the fact that you're listening. That's myocn.net. Do remember to always have faith in what you listen to.